In December, a popular uprising erupted in Greece after 15-year-old Alexandros Grigoropoulos was killed by police in a largely anarchist Athens neighborhood of Exarchia. Antonis V, a contributor to the blog Voices of Resistance from Occupied London, spoke with Carmel Wolfson and Macho Filipovich about the occupations, anarcho-transit actions, the blocking of an arms shipment heading to Israel to bomb Gaza, the legacy of the 2004 Athens Olympics, the solidarity statement of the haunt of Albanian migrants, and much more in the following interview.
Vancouver in Canada is hosting the Olympics in 2010, and there's been a lot of resistance to this, and it's going to be a pretty big deal when it happens. So I'm interested in the 2004 Olympics that happened in Athens that sounded like around the same time this kind of stuff started, and if the same things are happening there that are happening in Canada with closed-circuit television cameras being installed and all kinds of repressive measures being enacted.
Okay, so what was happening in Athens around that time is that... Basically, the authorities, the city authorities and the police wanted to make sure that they're going to sweep Exarchia clean together with the rest of the city center before the games. So they had a few kind of like operations, like one of them would even be like clearing the streets off stray dogs and cats. There's a lot of them in Greece. So they did that. They also tried to kind of like contain some areas of the city center with the junkies that are also... around the city center, and of course it tried to, in some way, to limit the anarchists and the leftists who are in Exarchia as well. But what happens with Exarchia is that it has way too many anarchists and leftists. Like most, it's really impressive to see, but most of the area is basically, almost controlled by our groups, basically. So when we also tried to install CCTV, there was a first kind of like major installation of CCTV in Greece for the games. Greece didn't really have that many cameras before at all. So I think they installed about 1,000 cameras in the city center, out of which we estimate that more than half, probably around half, possibly more, have been destroyed by activists, anarchists and leftists, who usually go out, often even in broad daylight, and just destroy the cameras, having a very, very good reception by the crowds, like passers by. Usually they don't have any problems at all. So that's been really good. It's been one of the kind of like main kind of terrains of struggle, I don't think there's many operational cameras in Exarchia at all at the moment. Now that said, of course, that police operation did cause a lot of problems. There was literally riot police surrounding Exarchia and trying to control people going in and out, and there was a lot of problems with them for a while. But they were also often targeted by activists, and eventually, I think like a year ago, they kind of like retreated a bit. They realized that they were just creating too much tension. Until, of course, December happened, which was one of the first attempts to regain entry to the area, and with the result that you know already.
Can you talk about the neighborhood of Exarchia, where this uprising began in December?
Exarchia is one of the most central Athens districts. I think it's actually the most central residential Athens district. And it's kind of like historically... being linked to the left and to the anarchist kind of communities, and mostly because it's the area where most of the universities used to be and still are. For the past, I think, 4 or 5 years, there had been a lot of tension with the police, because the police had kind of like put this kind of a new plan where they would surround the area with riot police units pretty much permanently. So you have this area where there's riot police units in its periphery 24/7, 365 days a year. They still are. kind of like randomly taking people, kind of trying to create tension. So what happened with Alexis in December was, in a way, an accident waiting to happen. You know, lots of people had said, you know, that this was a matter of time before it happens, and it did.
Are you able to give a bit of a timeline from when Alexandros was shot to when the Polytechnic and the other two universities were occupied, and sort of what steps led up to that?
Basically, okay, so Alexandros was shot on the night of the 6th of December, that was a Saturday. As soon as the news was spread, and what's really important is the news was spread first and foremost via in the media. Athens in the media was the first media outlet to have the news on, just because, you know, local residents just put out news as soon as they heard the gunshots. They said, you know, someone was shot. And then later on they said, you know, a kid has been assassinated. As soon as that happened, people literally spontaneously just met out in the streets. Everyone just took to the streets. I mean, I wasn't in the country yet, but the way it's been described to me is that everyone seemed to just, you know, get out of the houses and go and, you know, see what they can do. On that very first night, on that Saturday, there was, of course, there was massive rioting in Athens, in Thessaloniki, in Patra, at least another three or four big cities. There was demonstrations in 42 cities in the country, which is pretty much all the cities that the country has, really. And all this spontaneity in the demonstrations was thanks to the media, which was carrying the news. I think, although I wasn't in the country, I think that the universities were occupied on that very first night. People just, at the end of the night, you know, just realized that, you know, if they can't just go back home, you know, just pretending that, you know, this is over. So they just entered the universities and held them for the next three weeks. Second night, on a Sunday, on during the day as well, there was also massive rioting, and then on the third one too. So you had 3 days and nights of huge rioting, and then from the fourth day on, just a constant, you know, state of revolt basically across the country. The way it worked is that people occupied the three main universities in Athens, which were the law school, the economics school, and the polytechnic. Different anarchist groups occupied the three buildings. So from that point on, we just had, I was in the economics university, we had daily assemblies of around 700 people in each university, and where we would decide what kind of actions we'd do, you know, day after day, what kind of demonstrations we'd participate in, and, you know, under what terms, that kind of thing. So in terms of getting involved, like everyone else, I mean, it was just, it's difficult to even describe how it worked, but it was basically like an endless demonstration for about 3 weeks. I've never experienced anything like this in my life. You'd constantly be on the streets, like two or three demonstrations every day for 3 weeks.
What decision-making process was used when the decision was made to occupy the universities?
I think in terms of actually occupying it, it was probably almost an instinct, kind of like, you know, people realizing they don't want to go home, they have to retreat somewhere to be safe from the police. And this is something really important. The universities in Greece are covered by the so-called academic asylum law, which was a direct outcome of people's outrage at the 1973 raid of the Polytechnic in Athens, which you said you might be showing a film about. After this raid, was a public sentiment, you know, that this something that shouldn't ever happen again. So a law was introduced that prevents police and military from entering universities. So obviously people used this law to the benefit. They occupied the universities, which is a fairly easy thing to do, easier than it sounds anyway, because obviously the police can't stop you. And from that point on, every university had the university occupation had its own assembly. So we would have daily assemblies. Like I said, our assembly was about 700 strong, and I think the others were similar sizes. And decision making was completely under the, you know, anarchist kind of understanding of how things would work, you know, it was a consensus. It was very chaotic at times because you didn't even have, in most of these assemblies, you didn't even have someone, you know, facilitating the assembly, as incredible as it might sound. So 700 people talking for at least 4 or maybe 5, 6 hours at a time and deciding what they're going to do the next day. What was happening wasn't exactly a consensus, but mostly what people described as a dissensus, which was saying that if we can't reach an agreement altogether, which sometimes would happen, then pretty much the rule was as long as what you decide to do doesn't harm the occupation or doesn't work against what the rest of the occupation is doing, then you're free to go ahead and do it in whatever ways this might translate. So if you maybe want to leave a university and do a particular kind of attack and then run back into the university, maybe that wasn't cool unless the rest of the assembly had decided this was something agreeable. But if it wasn't something that you could be linked up to the university, for example, to the occupation of the university, then no one could stop you from doing it. You were free to do it. So this was a kind of idea that as long as what you do doesn't harm what the other people do, you can do it. And also there was this sense of like urgency and like doing something really important that most like minor differences were put aside.
How coordinated were people inside the university with others who were on strike?
Not maybe as much as we'd like to be. Basically, that was one. First of all, the strike was only for one day. The general strike only lasted for one day. That was the Wednesday
right.
after the assassination. But we did. That was one of our main bets. We did try to outreach to the rest of the people on the streets. In from the economics university, we did a newspaper. The issues of a newspaper of all the texts that we had written on the revolt, and where you would print a few thousand copies every time and give them out, obviously for free, to people on the streets. Again, completely using and abusing the university's facilities because we just printed all of that stuff in their basement. Then there was all the trade unions who refused to call for another general strike. So people occupied the main trade union, the reformist trade union building. Media occupations also happened because people realized that the media was either broadcasting lies or not even talking about the revolt at all. There was after the third or the fourth day, there was a kind of a media blackout on the revolt because media realized that even bad publicity was working for us. You know, that was kind of like advertising what was going on. So we just stopped talking about the revolt altogether. And that's when people started occupying radio stations, but also in a few occasions, TV stations, taking over the program and broadcasting their message directly.
How much was the uprising itself led by students and how much by other groups?
That's a bit hard to tell because at most points you have this feeling that everyone was on the streets, and it was true, you know, people from all sorts of social, political, and age groups. But I'd say the two kind of groups that impressed me the most were the high school kids. Like I said before, I mean, that was something absolutely incredible to see 14, 15, and 16-year-olds out on the streets with absolutely no sense of fear for the police, just a lot of anger, just attacking the police with like bare hands or with like whatever they had, and the police really, really brutally, you know, hitting back on them. But the students were incredible, the high school kids, and without them, again, this wouldn't have been what it was. They were absolutely amazing. At some point there was about 800 high schools occupied by the students across the country. Which is out of, yeah, it's about 80%, because high schools are about 1,000. So it's a very, very big number. And then there was the migrants in Greece are, many of them, if not most of them, are relatively new in the country. So they're all, the big majority is post-1990. So they've been around for the last 18 years, which by Western society standards is fairly new. So this was pretty much the first main political event in which they participated in big numbers, you know. And again, they were absolutely magnificent. They took the lead in cases on the streets and in the assemblies and everywhere. And they, it's really important, they were the ones, I think, who were most badly hit back by the Greek state. You know, the migrants who were arrested during the revolt were almost immediately convicted and in many cases deported with pretty much no evidence against them, convicted of looting. You know, there was this kind of assumption in the Greek justice system that if you're a migrant and you're arrested during the revolt, obviously for them you were looting. So we can't even tell, we can't even get access to information of how many of them have been arrested and deported. But we know that, you know, it's a very big number. So they really did pay a very high price, but still really impressive, because I think it's pretty much the first event in which political event in which migrant communities participate in such huge numbers, and that's a huge asset.
Why do you think that happened?
I think they realized they had this was the opportunity for them to express a rage for all the things they've been put through from the Greek state in the past. So of course there's actually an excellent text, I don't know if you've come across it, by the Albanian migrant haunt in Athens. It's a really, really cool Albanian group based in Athens who were explaining this really nicely and basically saying this was our opportunity for all the times that we didn't speak out before, because suddenly we saw all these other people expressing their rage and we felt we could join up with them and do the same.
During the uprising, Israel started its bombing campaign in Gaza, and I wanted you to talk about the solidarity that happened in Greece with respect to that struggle that was happening in the occupied territories.
It did, and first of all, maybe I should say that historically Greece has, the Greek left and even the Greek anarchist movement as well have historically had some strong solidarity links with the Palestinian struggle. So as soon as this happened, of course, there was a lot of focus was put on solidarity with the Palestinian people. It was a bit unfortunate, if you can talk in these terms, the attack happened towards the end of the revolt. So a lot of us have been wondering what would have happened if the two events had kind of coincided more closely, you know. But even so, like, I think it was just before or just after Christmas that Israel started the attack, I can't remember, but the news, I don't know if you heard about this, the most impressive thing that happened was that the news spread that Israel was going to use one Greek port to have some ammunition sent, like the United States was going to use it to send an order to Israel, basically. They were going to use a small private port. As soon as this happened, some of the Palestinian groups put out a call out to the insurgents of Greece to block this kind of a shipment from going through. And literally, less than 24 hours later, I think up to 10 Greek groups have put out call-outs for a blockade of the port. And then again, a few hours later, the United States issued a statement saying we're going to cancel the shipment in fear of the demonstrations. So that was really impressive. I mean, obviously, it was pretty much symbolic. You know, it didn't stop the war, didn't stop the attack on Gaza, but it was really impressive, I think, in symbolic terms that the Greek movement managed to even do stop a single shipment to Israel. Other than that, there was a lot of demonstrations outside the Israeli embassy, kind of similar stuff to what you saw in other European and, I guess, global cities around the globe.
And that was a shipment of arms, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can you describe the anarcho-transportation actions that happened?
Uh-huh. These were some actions that kind of, I think, mostly started from the Economics University occupation. And the idea was, I think it was well into the second week of the revolt, probably, when people realized that, you know, tiredness was kicking in, that people were not, you know, that the revolt was kind of losing its pace. And we decided that we had to find ways to spread the revolt into the city and across time. So one of the ideas was that, you know, we need to kind of to to make more people move freely and less products. You know, the whole idea is in the city, products move around freely and people have to pay for moving around, and we wanted to invert this. So what we tried to do, and worked out quite nicely, was to go around underground metro stations and to block the ticket validation and the ticket issuing machines. So to block only the function of the metro that, you know, forces its passengers to pay. So to allow people to move freely without any kind of like repercussions on their side. So what would usually happen is that you'd get people, groups of anything between 10 and 30 people going into a station, writing slogans, giving out propaganda to the passengers, explaining what this is all about, and then sabotaging, blocking the machines so that people could get a free ride without having to worry about the controls.
I've heard about masks or maybe hoodies being banned at one point within the last couple of months. There was also the death of a prison activist in custody. Do you want and it'd be interesting to hear also about what's going on the ground and how where the struggle's at right now.
It's really hard to even start from describing exactly because there's so many events. Like something seems to be happening every day. There has been, the government has attempted, they've introduced this weird new law, which doesn't quite ban hoodies. It's not like what happens in Germany where you're not allowed to demonstrate with a hoodie. That's how they try to present it, but this is completely unenforceable in Greece. So what they've actually done is that they've said that if you do get arrested and you do get convicted for rioting or, violently demonstrating, then should you be wearing a hoodie at the time, you would get an added up sentence kind of thing. Which again is completely unenforceable, because if a police arrest you, they can charge you whatever the hell they want anyway. You know, they're not really accountable. And they're really, really notorious on just putting fake charges onto people anyway. So it was more of a media stunt, if anything else. What they are trying to do, however, and that's much more serious, is that they have this new kind of attorney general, I think, of the country's high court, who's given out a very specific order to the regional attorney generals to look into the local squads, basically the anarchist squads, and to see what the situation is with them legally, whether and how they're kind of like breaking the law, which is kind of like, it seems to be a kind of a prelude into like an attack on some of the squads. So what we are expecting now is that probably, most certainly, there will be some attempted raids against some of the anarchist occupations across the country. People are thinking the most probably one is one in Thessaloniki, but it could be any of the main squads.
Do you think this is going to take the form of evictions or arrests?
It would probably be a combination, yeah. So if the only way that we could do this, it would be like with a major kind of a police operation. You know, they would need a lot of riot police to clear off any of these squads. And of course, people are absolutely prepared to defend them. And this is where the focus is at the moment. You know, the anarchist occupations in each city are coordinating. They're doing common actions, common like propaganda, kind of like demonstrations, events, and trying to build up a defense network, because we are expecting this to happen. It would be really stupid on their side, because I really don't think how they can evict any of the squads at the moment without having a major battle. The question is whether they're preparing to take it on or not, really. That's with the occupations. Of course, yeah, there is the death of the prisoner and activist that you mentioned. She was called Katerina Guglioni, and her case was also really important. She was very active in the prison revolt that preceded the one in December. There was a prison revolt in 2007 and a major prison action only a month before Alexis' assassination. And Katerina was a very prominent activist and involved in these revolts. As a form of punishment for her participation, she was ordered for a prison transfer to Crete from mainland Greece, where she was. And we do know for a fact that during these transfers, the guards take the opportunity to usually beat up prisoners. This seems to be what happened with Katerina, and upon arrival to Crete, she was found quote-unquote, was found dead. There has been a few actions in solidarity with Katerina as well, and this is part of a wider kind of like, how would you call it, like the wider kind of like atmosphere after December, which says that no attack will be tolerated anymore, you know, that no attack on the side of the state would, should be left unanswered kind of thing. So her case is something that might have kind of passed completely unnoticed before December, but not anymore. You know, people won't really allow for this to happen any longer, which is really important, I think.
If people are interested in keeping up on what's going on in Greece, there's obviously your blog. If you want to give the website address to that, that'd be great. And if there are other resources people can draw on and that you want to mention, that'd be great too.
Yeah, the blog where we kind of post the regular updates on what's going on is on occupiedlondon.org/blog. Also, Libcom, from as far as I know, it's libcom.org. They do a really good job in sending some substantial updates. And obviously, Athens in the media, its English section should have quite regular updates on the situation.
What do you think that we can learn from Greece when we look at our own organizing strategy here? Obviously, you know, it's a different situation in the UK, in North America.
Well, I guess the biggest kind of lesson, having lived in a country like the UK myself, where, you know, you might think that, you know, neoliberalism is a never-ending kind of a nightmare. The main lesson is that, you know, it's not, and it's something that can be shattered and can collapse literally overnight, you know, as long as enough people believe, you know, it's had its time. So that's the one main lesson, you know, don't despair after so many years of a neoliberal nightmare, because it might be coming to an end soon. And then other than that, you know, we just need to build the kind of infrastructure to be ready for that moment, you know, whether that infrastructure is physical, as in, you know, occupations, whether it's a network of information, for example, like something like in the media, whether it's like building alliances with people that you're going to find yourself working with, like social groups, like, you know, like we had the students and the migrants in Greece, you know, just make plans, be ready, and, you know, it's probably coming to a town near you. Like I said, there's so many things happening, like from the smallest kind of attacks to the great numbers of the anarchists now having the demonstrations. People seem to be expecting, everyone seems to be wondering what's next, you know, which obviously for one means, you know, that nothing is over, you know, people don't think this is over by a long shot. But I think same goes for most of the countries, you know, we just came back from visiting some of the neighboring countries where we're discussing with people about the Greek revolt. And it's amazing to see not only how much it's been like known, you know, people have how much people know about it, but how much people share our frustration and think that they should be doing the same kind of thing. And I think this is really important, you know, this is a direction we should be heading in. If we can all join up in this, then things are going to be pretty good.
You've been listening to Macho Filipovic and Carmel Wolfson interviewing Antonis V, a contributor to the blog Voices of Resistance from Occupied London, who participated in the popular uprisings in Greece, which started in December of 2008. You can read Antonis V's blog at occupiedlondon.org. Black Mask would like to thank Carmel Wolfson for her assistance in this segment.